views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One small step for man.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Another really good and different show today because I bet you don't know anything about the person we're going to talk about. But let's see when I introduce our guest and our topic in just a few minutes. For those of you that have access to your telephone and you want to call in and participate in our discussion, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Be patient. I'll answer and get you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you not using the phone for whatever reason, email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then remember, you can also go to our website, which is thespaceshow.com. On the far right side are upcoming shows. This is the first show listed for today with Rob Godwin. And open that archive page up and go to the bottom for comments. And you can post a question or a comment, and I will get it almost instantly and can bring that up on the air as well for our guest today. So those are the three ways that you can participate with us. Phone calls, of course, are always preferred, 1-866-687-7223. Also on our website, thespaceshow.com, the website newsletter is there, center right, and it's uploaded every Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. So it does detail the week's programs, but it also shows you all of the programs planned for the coming weeks and months ahead, and we're booking into April. So you can see we've got quite a few programs already planned coming up. Everything we do is archived, so remember you can listen off of our website or easily and rapidly download the programs. There is a store if you're interested in Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature, and it is in the upper left menu under the word support, and you'll see it there. The most important part of our Space Show website to me is the Support the Space Show, because we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we require or need your support, your contributions, because that's what keeps us on the air and keeps us going. So do remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you pay California taxes. And you can support us there through PayPal, where there are instructions for sending a check if you don't want to use PayPal. And if you have any questions, email me. Please use drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also, check out our nonprofit site at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. So do remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, and everybody has our permission to download our shows and share them around, as well as the URLs. Do remember not to do anything commercial with the programs, and don't edit them and then put edits up on YouTube or anything like that, including your own website. And written transcripts are not permitted. Even if they're for your own use, please do read our full copyright statement. And it is at the bottom of each of our website pages for thespaceshow.com, as well as OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we do have sponsors, and do check out their banner ads from time to time. We really do appreciate that. For the first segment of today's program, the Space Finance Group would like you to know that they're a team of space advocates with crowdfunding experience. Members of their team have helped raise over $1 million through crowdfunding, and they would like to help you raise the funds you need to get your space project going. If your space idea can be moved forward for under $250,000. Crowdfunding can be the ideal solution. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects. We understand space. We're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan, and we understand the audience you need to reach. So do visit us online at spacefinancegroup, all one word, .com. And then you can reach them by email at jjay.witner, W-I-T-T-N-E-R, at spacefinancegroup.com. Remember, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. The Space Foundation also supports us, and they have their 33rd, boy, that's a long time, Space Symposium coming up. So don't miss it. It's the premier global space conference this year. It is April 3rd to April 6th in Colorado Springs. Their website is spacesymposium.org. And Celestis is a sponsor, and they are the premier Memorial Spaceflight Service since 1995. Their website is memorialspaceflight.com, and they fly heroes to Earth orbit, as you hear me talk about from time to time. They are preparing to launch their 7th Earth orbit Memorial Spaceflight, which will occur from the Cape later this year. It's called the Heritage Flight, in honor of the rich history of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station and the neighboring NASA Kennedy Space Center. On board will be the former astronaut and space show guest, William Pogue, who flew on Skylab for 84 days, as well as Staff Sergeant John Cleaver, a highly decorated vet of both the Navy and the Army. He did die a hero in Afghanistan, sacrificing himself to prevent a suicide bomber from entering the main gate of their base. What better way to commemorate the life of someone who was fascinated by the space program, dreamed of flying in space, or wondered at the beauty of the night sky, than to make them part of the Celestis Memorial launch out of Cape Canaveral? Reservations are open now for this historic mission. And I'm happy to reintroduce and bring back to the show, he's been absent for way too long, Rob Godwin of Apogee, and he is the owner and the founder of Apogee Space Books. He was the space curator at the Canadian Air and Space Museum in Toronto. He has written or edited almost 200 books, including the award-winning series, The NASA Mission Reports. Robert has appeared on dozens of radio and television programs in Canada, the States, and in England, including CNN, the CBC, BBC, CBS, Discovery Channel, History Channel, and MTV, and The Space Show, which he forgot and left off of that list. He produced the first ever virtual reality panorama of the Apollo lunar surface photography and the first multi-camera angle movie of the Apollo 11 moonwalk. For his contribution to the field of near-Earth asteroids, the IAU named a main belt asteroid 4252 Godwin. In 2015, he wrote a paper on William Leach, introduced a new name to the history of space exploration, and I have his book, and it's William Leach, L-E-I-T-C-H, Presbyterian Scientist, excuse me, and the Concept of Rocket Spaceflight, 1854 to 1864. I bet none of you have heard of William Leach. Rob, welcome back to the show, and tell us how you stumbled onto this. I think that's an interesting story as well.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me back on. It's very, very kind of you to have me back. Yeah, it was really serendipity. I was out in Seattle at a meeting, and I had a few hours off, and I went to a used bookstore, as I usually do, looking for space books, and stumbled across a copy of Ken Gatland and Anthony Kunish's book, Space Travel, which they had written in 1953. And I immediately recognized it as one that I didn't have, and so I paid out my $10 and put it in my bag and then read it on the flight on the way home. And very few pages into the book, I came across this reference to somebody who had written about rockets for spaceflight based on Newtonian principles. And Gatland and Kunish had attributed this to a book that had been published in 1899 called Half Hours in Air and Sky. But they didn't know who'd written it. And as soon as I saw 1899, I thought, well, That's really early. I mean, that predates the first publication of Tsiolkovsky. It predates certainly the first publication of Oberth or Goddard. And I thought, well, this kind of shakes things up if it really is from 1899. So when I got home, I Googled this book, Half Hours in Air and Sky. And sure enough, there it was, except the edition that Google had scanned was dated 1876. And, of course, that's a huge difference in the terms of, you know, the history of rocketry and spaceflight. But it still didn't say who'd written it. So I read through it, and sure enough, there was this amazing quotation about rockets and Newtonian principles for spaceflight. So I thought, well, I've got to find out who wrote this. And so I basically took a sentence from the essay that was random enough that it would be something that might appear if I searched another way. And I dropped that into Google search engine. Up came God's Glory in the Heavens, written by Principal William Leach of Queen's College in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. And the date on the edition that Google had scanned was in the 1870s, and it said third edition. So I thought, wow, you know, this is amazing. When was the first edition? Well, that took a lot more digging, and actually I had to go to the libraries at the universities locally to me to find when it first appeared, and I traced it all the way back to pre-Jules Verne and to September of 1861, which in the grand scheme of things is remarkable. And that's when I thought, I need to make some phone calls.
What is a Presbyterian scientist and religious leader doing talking about rockets going to space?
Yeah, that's what I thought. I didn't know anything about him when I first found this essay. I had no idea who he was. And, of course, it caught my attention that he was based here in Canada, because, as you know, I'm in Toronto. And I thought, well, this is a potentially a great little nugget of early Canadian aerospace history that I could put into a presentation that I was about to do in Ontario here for Space Week. Anyway, I started researching this chap and tried to find out more about who he was, and became more astounded by the minute when I tracked it back and kept tracking it back. I found out that he was indeed a ordained Presbyterian minister and an enthusiastic astronomer. But before I even got that far, I had actually gone into all of my usual sources to try and see who else might have stumbled across this guy. And when I say the usual sources, I'm talking about books like Ron Miller's Dream Machines, which you may have seen. It's a fantastic book that Ron did. And sure enough, it was mentioned in there, and it looked like Ron had actually got the same source that Gatlin had and didn't know who had written it either, but also had the foresight to say that he thought that it might be earlier than Gatlin's original copy of 1899. I looked in David Baker's book, The Rocket. You know, David's the editor of Spaceflight magazine in the BIS in London now.
Right.
I went through all of Frank Winter's, well, I shouldn't say all of them, but a lot of Frank Winter's essays. Frank was the curator at the Smithsonian. And his Prelude to the Space Age book, which is an excellent source. And then finally, Mike Cianconi, who's the chairman of the AAAS History Committee, he did a book called The Literary Legacy of the Space Age, which covers all the books that were written about space before Sputnik. And I couldn't find anybody, any of them, that actually identified who this man was. So I started phoning all these guys and saying, you know, am I completely out to lunch here, or is this a big deal? And thankfully, all of them seemed to think it was a big deal.
So what did Minister Leach want to do? I mean, did he want to see space travel, or was he just talking about the idea of a rocket making it possible?
I think he was living in, obviously, a completely different world to us. He'd been born in Rothesay on the island of Bute, off the west coast of Scotland in 1814. So his age made him actually contemporaneous with Jules Verne and Charles Dickens and people like that. And he'd been put through a really sophisticated education at Glasgow University and had been attracted to astronomy. but he had also been sort of slated to be ordained as a minister because his grandfather had been a minister as well. And so he studied up on divinity, amongst other things. But he always had his eye on astronomy. And I think probably there's a lot of people today who find it very difficult to reconcile what you can see through a telescope and the strict interpretation of Christian scripture. And Leach was one of those guys. He was reading his Bible on Sundays and reading science and astronomy texts like the Royal Astronomical Society's journal during the week and finding it very difficult to reconcile these two different worlds that were being presented to him. And so he spent the rest of his adult life doing astronomy, teaching about astronomy, and particularly trying to address the very contentious subject of life on other planets. And so when it came to explaining that, he became a popularizer, like sort of in the vein of Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson, where he would run around doing lectures to not just his own parish, but parishes all across Scotland, where he would talk about science and teach people about science and then go back to his parish and do his chores as a minister at the parish.
Fascinating. So was it uncommon back then for people of religion to also be engaged in science? Was this highly unusual, or was this sort of a routine kind of thing?
I think it was quite common in Scotland at the time. You know, Scotland was at the front end of science and engineering at that time. You know, James Watt had just done his thing with fixing the steam engine, Newcomen's steam engine, and spawned the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And there was all kinds of very bright engineers and scientists working in Scotland at that time. And quite a lot of them were ordained ministers. And to me, at least, that was quite a surprise. I didn't realize that. Some of them had been trained to be ministers and then had rejected that life, whereas Leach was one of the ones who didn't. He thought that he could reconcile the two positions, and astonishingly, at least to my eyes, he seems to have done a heck of a job of doing that for the rest of his life.
So Leach, in his A Journey Through Space, proposes a rocket as the most efficient way to travel outside of Earth's atmosphere, I guess, or into space. Were there actually other ways of traveling through Earth's atmosphere to outer space at the time? I mean, what else was there for him to consider other than a rocket?
Well, there wasn't. I mean, we already knew how, more or less, how deep the atmosphere was. I mean, we'd known that for, you know, a couple of centuries at that point. We understood that, you know, the higher up you went, the thinner the air got. And Leach, in his writings, made it crystal clear that he understood the implications of very thin atmospheric pressure on winged flight. But, of course, there was no winged flight in his days. He was talking about birds. He also understood that, you know, balloons, which were a fairly new thing at that point, wouldn't work once you get above a certain altitude. So getting beyond that, I mean, we had all those sort of early science fiction parables, things like, Bishop Godwin's voyage to the moon in 1638, where he was, you know, hauled to the moon by a chariot being drawn by geese and that kind of thing. Nobody really knew how you could actually navigate the vacuum of space clearly until after Newton wrote his laws in the late 17th century. And it seems like Leach, although obviously there were other people who understood Newton's action and reaction in the principle of rocketry, Leach seems to have been the first one to have realized that it was the only thing that he could think of that would actually work in a vacuum. And most importantly, he realized that it would work better in a vacuum. And that was what made his writings all the more extraordinary, because people were still challenging that notion 50, 60 years later, when Robert Goddard started building his rockets. People were ridiculing him for the idea that he didn't understand that, you know, rockets wouldn't work in a vacuum. And of course, they work better in a vacuum. And Leach seems to have been the first one to have realized that.
Is there any way to tell if his rocket writings or anything related were popular during his time, or is he enjoying this notoriety only long after he's been gone?
No, it's quite extraordinary, actually. He, the first edition of his book came out in 1862. I mean, he'd actually anthologized the book as a series of essays in a magazine. And the magazine that they appeared in was called Good Words, which, again, was something I'd never heard of until I actually got into this. But it turns out that Good Words was the biggest-selling English-language magazine in the world for a couple of decades. And Leach was right there when the very first issue came out because the editor of it was a friend of his. And so that first sort of year and a half of Good Words magazine, Leach was in there virtually every month with an essay about space. And that would have been read by hundreds of thousands of people in his day. And so consequently, he did gain quite a bit of notoriety in his own time. And then when the book came out in 1862, where he updated it and anthologized everything, it sold out the first 1,000 copies in less than a year. It was published in the United States. It was published in Canada. It was available in Australia. It was available in India. It went into at least 4 editions in several of those territories before he died in 1864. And then subsequently after he died, his publisher got into all kinds of problems with his people that were providing money to him, and he lost control of the copyrights, and the people who took over those copyrights then took Leach's writings and continued to publish them, but without his name on them. And in that form, that was the form that Ken Gatlin came across. And in that format with no name on it, they continued to be printed until 1907. So, you know, his at least one advert says that that edition or that version of his writing sold over 500,000 copies. So he was everywhere for quite a long time.
This is like Von Braun and Disney and the magazines, but several hundred years earlier.
Yeah, kind of.
Did you see any of these early magazines?
Yeah, actually, it was quite challenging, though, because it turns out that there was a problem sometime in the mid to late 19th century where something had appeared in that particular magazine. It was called Good Words, that had upset some of the more evangelical sectors of the church in England. And there had been bonfires where people had collected up all of their copies of Good Words and burned them. And so consequently, individual issues of the magazine are actually quite hard to come by now, in fact, very hard to come by. But it would be bound at the end of each year. They would bind up the year's issues as volumes. And those have sort of survived in libraries around the world. So that was what I first got my hands on. And then subsequently, I had to go all the way back to the British newspaper library in England to actually find copies of the magazines with their original covers on them so that I could see whether his name was mentioned on the cover of the actual magazine, which it was.
Jerry is in Houston, Texas, with a question for you, and said, were there any flaws in his technical reasoning based on what we know today versus what he was talking about back in the 1850s or 60s?
Yeah, hi, Jerry. Obviously, there are some things which creep through, but he was very, very careful to not leap to conclusions. When they first suggested that there might be a planet inside the orbit of Mercury called Vulcan, they named it Vulcan, a lot of people were looking for it. And some very famous astronomers finally concluded that it must be there. But Leach was very cautious about suggesting that, you know, this was definitely there because he hadn't seen it. He liked the idea that it had been predicted by mathematical prediction. He thought that that was a sort of a mark of human intelligence, that we could make these kinds of a priori discoveries. But he was skeptical. And likewise, when they suggested that the solar system had been formed out of circles of swirling dust, he thought that was you know, an interesting notion, but wasn't willing to completely accept it until it had been proven. But he was careful. He was not one for throwing out sort of whimsical ideas. And most astonishingly, one of the things that he said, the position that he took that astonished me, was his ability to sort of dress down his fellow ministers if they would suggest that something was heretical. The science was sort of suggesting something heretical. And I've got this great quote here in front of me where he said, instead of attacking the scientific theory, the proper attitude is to deny the religious inference. Instead of denouncing the theory as atheistical, the only tenable position is to show that, though granted, it would not warrant the atheistical deduction. Now, he's basically saying if the science contradicts scripture, why automatically assume that that makes it atheistical? And for a minister, I thought that was really enlightened for his time.
Absolutely. I mean, do you know if he gave sermons to his church on the subject, or did he separate science and religion when he was preaching?
He actually encouraged scientific lectures to take I actually have one review where it talks about him encouraging somebody to do a scientific talk during Sunday school. And again, he sort of came back with this attitude, and I'm going to throw another quote at you because I just love these quotes, where he said, secular knowledge is God's truth as well as the Bible, and it would be the greatest libel on the latter to hold that there is a necessary conflict between them. And he lived his life like that. I mean, he was basically quite happy for people to talk about science in the classroom on Sundays, which most people at that time would have considered to be very in sort of wrong.
So how did all of this get lost and not brought back up in rocketry history until much more recent times? Because you did have Goddard and you had the others, and you know, rockets were certainly, they weren't being forgotten about. They were being talked about. You had people developing them. They played a role in the war. So how did he manage to get himself lost?
I put it down to the fact that he died very young. He died at 49 years old. He had only just published this one book, which was his one big work of his life. He had spent the better part of a decade building up his theories that ended up in that book. He'd been lecturing on astronomy and alien life on other planets and science since at least the early 1850s. And so when he died at 49 years old, when the book had only just gone into its first edition, he wasn't there to promote it. And it's the same today to some extent. You know, if an author passes away before they have a chance to do anything with it, the book generally tends to die. But it was complicated further by the fact that in those days, if you owed people a lot of money and you went out of business, they could put liens on all kinds of things. And his publisher, famous publisher called Alexander Strahan, who was based in Edinburgh, he had basically put all his copyrights up as collateral against the money he was owed, the money he owed to his printers. And when he lost control of the business, those printers didn't know who Leach was. Leach had already died, didn't particularly care. All they knew is that they owned all this material, and they just started printing it without his name on it. And one of the first things I did, of course, when I first came across this, was I tried to find out whether there was any copies of those unattributed texts, or even the attributed text, in any of the libraries in the Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts areas, to see whether it was possible that Goddard might have stumbled across it as a young man. And unfortunately, those records there don't go back far enough, so there's no way to really tell.
Is there an overall Presbyterian kind of archives and library, like there is the Vatican Library? Is there anything like that in the Presbyterian world?
They're scattered all over the place. And in fact, I spent some time in the library here in Toronto. Canada was, and to a great degree back in those days, was being populated by Scottish immigrants, and the Presbyterians played a big role in the formation of Canada, and including the first Prime Minister, John Macdonald, was a Scottish immigrant. So there's a fairly substantial Presbyterian archive here in Toronto, and I went and spent some time there. And I also got assistance from a number of different archives in the UK and Scotland, Cambridge University, St. Andrews University, Glasgow University, even the ministry in Fife, where he was the minister, they still had their records, and all these different people all over the place were helping me dig into this man's life.
Was the church upset with him for anything that he was doing?
Yeah, he actually had some run-ins, but he had powerful friends. One of his best friends was Norman MacLeod, who was one of the ministers for Queen Victoria. He was very high up in the church and would minister to the Queen at Balmoral in those days. And he was also Leach's editor. So Leach and MacLeod had gone to college and university together, and then worked on this magazine together. So he had connections that could protect him. But even having said that, he was considered to be not pious enough for people in Scotland and some of the factions of the church in Scotland, and too pious for some of the church people in Canada. So he couldn't win. And at one point, he actually was accused of preaching on the Sabbath on a ship going across the Atlantic. Having a party for the Prince of Wales, I should say, not preaching. And that made the front page of the newspapers, that this Presbyterian minister had the audacity to have a party on the Sabbath. Turned out to be not true, but his enemies were trying to sort of make it out that he was a bit of a villain because he wasn't evangelical enough for some of them.
Did he have children that you can track down today that maybe are in the space field or know anything about that?
I actually had a heck of a time tracking down living relatives, but I did find one. I found his great-great-grandson, who is still working for a law firm in Edinburgh, which the law firm had actually been formed about 100-and-something years ago and was responsible for the first female lawyer in Scotland to ever practice in Scotland.
Huh.
And that firm's still around, and Leach's great-great-grandson is still practicing law there. So I got in touch with him, and he's thrilled to bits about all the stuff we've been turning up.
Did he know anything about him?
He knew he was descended from him, but his last name is not Leach. It's a different name. His family history is pretty extensive. I mean, he's got a lot of family tree stuff on the wall, but the Leach line sort of ended with William Leach, and he didn't know anything beyond further back about Leach, so he was quite pleased to hear all this.
Ben is in Chicago, and he said earlier you mentioned alien life and extraterrestrial life. Did Leach know anything about that? Did he have assumptions? What did he say about life on other worlds?
It's interesting. The whole notion of alien life had been sort of on the table as a controversial subject since at least Christian Huygens' time. And Huygens had written a book about it, which he then was too afraid to publish while he was alive. It was published after he died. And Huygens' position was that there had to be life out there on other planets, and he gave all these rational reasons for why there should be. Huygens' position on that sort of filtered through to the end of the 17th century and came onto the desk of a fellow called Bernard de Fontenelle, who then wrote this amazing piece about alien life, which you, again, in those days was kind of heretical, and you could get in deep trouble for writing that kind of stuff. So de Fontenelle was very careful about how he worded it, because he published while he was alive. And his book of the plurality of worlds more or less settled the subject for a long time. Most people who had read de Fontenelle believed that there had to be life out there. And it wasn't until late 1853 that a distinguished scientist challenged de Fontenelle and wrote a piece anonymously where he used the same title of the, I can't even pronounce it, plurality of worlds. And that came out in late 1853, in December of 1853. And Leach seems to have jumped on that almost immediately and gone out to do a lecture about it 2 weeks later in St. Andrews at St. Andrews University in Scotland. And he basically dressed down whoever this anonymous author was who had been challenging de Fontenelle and said, look, you know, I look through telescopes every night and you know, if you have any concept of just how big the universe is, this is ridiculous, or words to that effect. And that was his first speech that I know of where he took on the idea of alien life. And interestingly, he shared a position on a council committee with Sir David Brewster. Now, Brewster, who was also a Scottish, he'd been trained as a minister and then was one of the ones that sort of walked away from the church and devoted his life to science, became very famous. Brewster became legendarily famous. And Brewster was the principal of St. Andrews when Leach came there to speak about this challenge about alien life. And so Brewster ran with it and then published his own essay about it a couple of months later, and then published this best-selling book where he took on the anonymous author of this piece. Turns out that Leach and Brewster both knew the guy who had written it. And it was a scientist called William Yule, who was actually a very, very smart guy, very bright guy, and made some extremely persuasive arguments for his time about why alien life might be very rare. And it turns out that they all knew each other. And so for the next decade or so, Leach then made it his job to run around to all these different community halls and town halls, lecturing on what he saw through telescopes at night when he was in the observatories and why he thought that alien life was very likely.
Were there any alien stories back then? Did they think that there had been alien visits to Earth? Any abductions? None of that was going on at the time.
No. I mean, Voltaire had written a sort of piece about an alien coming to Earth. The story was called Micromegas, and it was a satire based, you know, taking aim at the political elite of the time.
And Verne wrote his classic.
Verne's stuff. He's From the Earth to the Moon was 1865, but there was nothing about alien abductions that I know of. As far as I'm aware, that began. It was first proposed in a fictional book called Edison's Conquest of Mars in 1898, and that was where you first came across alien abductions, Martians coming to Earth, building the pyramids, taking us humans back to Mars to be their slaves, that kind of stuff. So that's quite a long time after Leach.
Of course, and that was the true story of it all, right?
Absolutely. That's what Stargate came from.
That's right. Chris wanted to know if Leach has been recognized for his achievements in either Canada or Scotland. Is there a Leach Museum or library or anything like that?
Not yet, but I should say not yet. There hasn't been a library or a museum or anything like that. But Leach has, in fact, been recognized. And there's an organization called the Baird of Bute Society, which is based out of Bute, island off the west coast of Scotland. And it's called the Baird of Bute Society because it's named after Andrew Baird, who was Scotland's first aviator, who had built a monoplane in 1910 and flown it. He was the first man to fly a heavier-than-air vehicle in Scotland. So the Baird of Bute Society was already set up and running and recognizing this pioneer from Bute when we turned up this whole thing about Leach, who was also from there. And so the Baird of Bute Society has been working pretty diligently recently to recognize Leach in Scotland. And what's happened is there's now a William Leach Scholarship named after him at Glasgow Strathclyde University, which is now going to be given once a year by the current Lord Smith of Kelvin to send students to, I believe, Houston once a year to study aerospace. So that's really nice. And then just this week, Wednesday, I'm going to be at Queen's University here in Kingston, Ontario, where the Baird Butte Society are bringing an award from Scotland to present to the current principal of Queen's University to recognize Leach's accomplishments posthumously.
Interesting. So another comment posted on the Space Show blog, listeners, by Capitalists. It's quite long, but one of the things that caught my attention was he said, why was it so hard to realize that rockets would bring about the dawn of spaceflight? But nobody was really, spaceflight wasn't really being thought about or discussed around the 1850s or anything. That wasn't a serious topic of the day, was it?
No, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, once you got into these sort of early satirical references, I mean, you can go all the way back to Lucian of Samosata in whatever it was, 40 or 80 AD, with these satirical fantasies about traveling to the moon. But from 1638, when Bishop Francis Godwin wrote his first book, which spurred a scientific response from Bishop John Wilkins, who actually wrote a scientific paper essentially saying it might be possible to do commerce with the moon, is I think the words he used, or something to that effect. There really wasn't a lot of serious discussion about it until sort of the beginning of imperial expansionism, when it started to become trendy to stick a flag in a piece of ground somewhere and talk about claiming it. And, of course, there were discussions about, you know, whoever puts a flag on the moon could claim it for their imperial ambitions. And, of course, that notion went all the way through to when von Braun was pitching, you know, military lunar bases to the U.S. government in the 1950s, the idea of staking the high ground. But I don't think there was any really sort of long, ongoing, serious discussion about it until Jules Verne. I mean, when Jules Verne wrote his best-selling fiction about, you know, a trip to the moon, that captured all kinds of people's attention and certainly spurred people like Tsiolkovsky, Goddard, Oberth, von Braun, Korolev. They all cite Verne as being the sort of spark that lit the fire for them.
So Verne was the turning point.
Seems to be, yep. Even though Leach, you know, predates him by 4 years, you know, he sold an awful lot of books, but Verne became, you know, a household name the world over. He was treated like a rock star. I mean, there were no sports stars or rock stars or television stars or anything in those days, and authors were treated, you know, the way a rock star would be treated today. And, you know, Verne, when he traveled around the world, people knew he was coming. He'd get off the boat, and the docks would be loaded up with people waiting to greet him.
Did Leach ever meet Verne? Did they ever come across one another?
No, you know, I was so close. I decided that it was worth investigating to see just how contemporaneous they were with each other, and just came across this remarkable coincidence that Verne's mother was of Scottish descent, and he had decided to go back to Scotland to visit his mother's ancestral homeland, and he only went there once. And it turns out that he actually was in Edinburgh the same day that Leach was in Edinburgh. And based on the geography of where I know they were, my guess is that they were within about 300 meters of each other on one day in August of 1859, passing as ships in the night. And Leach was there to have discussions about coming to Canada to become the principal of Queen's University in Canada. And Verne was there. And was greeted by one of Leach's counterparts, who was a Catholic minister, and that gentleman invited Verne to come over to Fife, which is the other side of the Firth there. So Verne came within about 20 kilometres of Leach's house, and spent some time at this old mansion there, which is still there today. And evidently that mansion house was the inspiration for Verne's Nautilus submarine in his 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
I wonder what it would have been like if they had met and what might have come from that.
Yeah, well, of course, Verne was unknown at that point. And the only reason we know he even did this trip was because he wrote it down as a work of fiction and his publisher rejected it. And it sat in storage until the 1980s. When somebody dug it up and said, we should publish this, this is an unknown Verne story. And it was very clear that it was semi-autobiographical. It was about his own trip to Scotland. But he wasn't, nobody knew who he was when he made that trip to Edinburgh in Fife. You know, Leach wouldn't have even known who he was if he'd met him anyway.
That would be a fun little book to write, the story of their meeting and what happened from it and change history.
Alternative reality.
Yeah, an alternative reality book. We're at our halfway point, Rob, so I'm going to take a pause. Listeners, the phone number again is 1-866-687-7223 for those of you that are not listening at work and have the phone available. Email continues to be drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the...
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday Space Show program. We're talking to Rob Godwin, and we're talking about his book and the person, William Leach, Presbyterian scientist, and the concept of rocket spaceflight, 1854-64. Very quickly, we have two sponsors for the second segment. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then AIAA is a sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They have over 30,000 individual members, represent 88 countries, and 95 corporate members. Their membership helps shape the future of aerospace every day and help to advance the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together. Join them, visit them, participate with them. Their website is AIAA.org. And Rob Tiffany in Atlanta sent in a note and said, David, I'm still at work, so I'm using email. Everybody acts as if rocketry in the 1850s or something like that was a really big deal. Let's not forget that the Chinese were blowing things up with rockets for hundreds, if not thousands of years earlier. Rob, have you ever come across any early Chinese rocket books or rocketry statements or people that talked about using Chinese rockets to go to space?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I couldn't cite the title of a Chinese book, I'm afraid, but certainly the stories of Chinese rocketry that go back to, I think, the 12th century, the Battle of Kaifengfu or something like that. I probably pronounced that wrong. Was, you know, one of the first recorded incidents of using rockets in combat. Those rockets, of course, were powder rockets, you know, which is all that would have been around when Leach was alive. And they were, eventually those rockets were brought into the West through combat situations and then were refined. The British first came up against them in India in the 18th century. But they were really unruly weapons. You were almost in as much danger of firing them as you were having them fired at you. And they sort of went all over the place. And it wasn't until William Congreve, who was a British artillery officer, sort of brought some of those rockets back from India and refined them and realized that they could be made more stable by adding different equipment to them. And then a fellow called Hale, just shortly before Leach came along, was the one who figured out how to spin stabilize them by putting these vents on them that allowed them to rotate as they were flying and fly more directly. They would fly true to their target. So, yes, there was this long evolution from the sort of birth of gunpowder and black powder. There was a book called Bella Fortis written by Conrad of Eichenstadt or something like that, which described how a soldier in combat back in the 14th century could launch a rocket at his target using a sort of launching platform like a hollowed out plank. There were all these different ideas for that. But the thing about Leach, of course, is that he was coming on the heels of not only Newton explaining why they worked, but also on the heels of Hale figuring out spin stabilization. And the idea that if you put rotation on a rocket, it would fly straight. Leach, in fact, lectured on the subject of the Minier rifle, which was the first rifle that actually had a slug instead of a ball, and the slug had this soft skirt on it. And when it was fired out of the rifle, it would cause it to spin, and it became much more accurate. And we have proof that Leach was lecturing on the Minier rifle while he was still in Scotland. So he was clearly understanding things like spin stabilization as well as Newtonian action and reaction.
Was there any Chinese talk about using rockets for space flight or going up in astronomy, or was it all about weapons?
You know, I've tried to dig further into this, but it's because it's very difficult if you don't read Chinese or speak Chinese. There is this apocryphal story about the legend of this one Chinese emperor who supposedly wanted to fly to space and had them put rockets on his chair and launched him into oblivion. But that has been sort of disavowed in recent years as being something that was invented in the 20th century and that it's not actually a true Chinese legend. That's the only one that I'm aware of that even comes close to addressing Chinese rocket spaceflight.
Interesting. Now, Leach was involved in non-space science and rockets too, right? I mean, he was an all-around scientist, I guess, of his time. What were his special interests other than rockets?
Well, I mean, primarily it was astronomy for him, but he was also a trained botanist, and perhaps not coincidentally, the observatory that he worked at in Glasgow was set up right next door to this huge new botanical gardens that was built literally outside the gates of the observatory. When he came to Canada, he established the Botanical Society of Canada, which is still in existence today, and he was the first sitting chairman of that organization. He was interested in geology. We have at least one instance of him going on a geological field trip. And he also was involved in establishing faculties of medicine and law at Queen's University. He wrote papers on engineering, particularly on steam power, when he was at Glasgow. So not only was he lecturing on ballistics, but he was writing papers on steam power for driving for propulsion. while he was still working on his MA at Glasgow. Of course, he studied divinity, which, you know, was his thing. He was a minister. So he was a bit of a polymath. You know, he got very high grades in mathematics and natural philosophy, which is what they called science in those days. And you know, he went through BA, MA, and then was made Doctor of Divinity before he left Scotland.
Fascinating. And then he goes to Canada, and then he comes to the United States, right?
Yeah. Once he was appointed to this post as principal of this Presbyterian College in Canada, Queen's College, known as Queen's University today, which incidentally is where Elon Musk went to school. Once he came over here, he sort of walked into a bit of a firestorm of political intrigue at that moment, where the money that had been assigned to run these schools was being misappropriated, and so he spent up a lot of energy doing that. But one of the first things he did was he tried to make sure that the observatory in Kingston had more permanent surroundings, and that required a big telescope, which was built for him by Alvin Clark, who was probably the best optics man in the world at that time, who was based in Massachusetts. And so Leach became good friends with Alvin Clark and went down to visit him on at least two occasions that we know of in Massachusetts. And first time he went down there, the American Civil War had just begun. And Leach wrote about how he heard them walking the streets, all the soldiers were getting ready to go into combat, singing the Star Spangled Banner, which of course was all about rockets being fired at Fort McHenry in 1814. And he was saddened by it. He thought that it was very sad that this war seemed inevitable. And he spent some time talking with Clark. They talked about telescopes for rifles. Telescopic sights, as we would know them today. And then later he went back again the following year, and of course things were not going great for the Union at that point, and there was a lot of injured people were now walking the streets, and Alvin Clark was now making more telescopic sights for weapons and was more wrapped up in military work than he was on his telescopes. But Clark, actually, his son discovered the companion star to Sirius B was discovered by Clark's son using one of those telescopes. And at one point, Leach actually had to close the college at Queen's and start getting the students to do military training, because there was this terrible incident where it looked like Britain might end up going to war with the Union over overzealous act that had happened off the Bahamas, and a couple of Confederate ambassadors had managed to break through the Union blockade and got aboard a British mail steamer and were heading through the Bahamas when they were intercepted by a Union warship, and the Union warship fired at the British ship, made them heave to, boarded them, took the two Confederate officers off the ship. And this almost triggered war again between England and or Britain, the British Empire, and the Union. And so Leach was traveling the Atlantic back and forth when all this was going on, and was right there on board one of these ships when there were some Union and Confederate officers who almost came to blows in the lounge on board the ship. When he came back, he was involved with training the troops in case Britain indeed came in as another enemy of the Union. But thankfully, Prince Albert, the Queen's husband, wrote a pretty diplomatic letter to Abraham Lincoln, and Lincoln then responded with the right response, released the two Confederate officers, and defused the whole situation. So all that was going on while Leach was trying to run a school.
Did he make multiple trips to the United States, or just basically to see Clark in Massachusetts?
Well, there's at least two trips that I know of. And one of those trips, he actually went through Albany, New York, and visited the observatory there, which is still there today and is considered the oldest observatory in the United States. And the man running that was Ormsby Mitchell, who had just been made an officer in the Union Army when he got there. And, of course, Mitchell gained notoriety a couple of years later as being the man who took Huntsville, Alabama from the Confederacy, which, as you know, became the center of America's rocket program many years later. So there's all these nice little connections there.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to go back and see what these people did and how it relays back into today. I wonder where we would be if, I guess someone else would have come along probably and come up with these theories and these ideas about rockets and all of that. Did the people coming after Leach, they didn't reference Leach's work, did they?
Not about the rockets.
That's what I mean about rockets, yeah.
I did find at least two or three references, people citing Leach, in the late 19th century, in the sort of long after he was dead in the 1880s, 1890s, people citing his book. But usually they were referencing, you know, astronomy. And the fact that his book had actually, when it was originally written, it was going to reference the fact that it was about astronomy in the title. And then when the book was actually published, they removed the astronomy reference from the title, and it was just called God's Glory in the Heavens. And so it's my estimation, at least, that it was probably filed under theology in some libraries. And so any citations that did come, there were a few that I've seen, and I'll probably find more, were referencing his comments about astronomy. And I've also noted that some of the people who referenced him completely misinterpreted what he was saying. If you actually go back and read what he wrote and then what they thought he'd written, they got it completely wrong. And you know, he was sort of done a disservice by some of the reviewers and citations.
I know from earlier space show programs with you over the years that you have an incredible knowledge about this history and the players and science fiction and all of this. Have you ever attempted, or would you ever consider organizing and putting down all of Rob Godwin's knowledge on these subjects into one big comprehensive encyclopedic volume?
Well, it's nice that you would suggest that. I have actually been writing that book for about 15 years. And I don't expect I'll ever finish it, but I've been plundering it and taking pieces out of it for other projects. And so it's appearing in pieces, usually as afterwards or forewords. And indeed, some of it's in this book about Leach. Some of the information that's in there about Bernard de Fontenelle and William Ewell and so forth all comes out of that bigger project that I've been working on for a long, long time.
Do you have a research staff, or do you just do this? Like, how did you find out about de Fontenelle?
It's just me.
So it's just you. And
yeah, I have a pretty substantial library. I'm sitting in a room right now surrounded by probably 8 6-foot by 4-foot bookshelves that are full. I have a lot of books, a lot of magazines, a lot of source material. And, of course, I think I mentioned this to you before, a lot of people who are retiring and their families don't want their paperwork and so on are giving that stuff to us here at Apogee to try and preserve, digitize, and so forth. So we've been working away on that, putting it up on that website, thespacelibrary.com, which I mentioned to you once before.
Right.
We have a bit of a problem with it right now where we had some people trying to hack the site recently. So we had to shut down letting new people in at the moment, but we expect we'll have that fixed in a couple of weeks.
Why would they care about hacking the site? They can access it.
Well, you know, they have bots that do this, right? And these bots go trawling any site, really, looking for people's information. If they can get passwords, credit card information, email addresses, that kind of thing. And fortunately, we have a pretty good firewall there. They never got past creating hundreds of fake accounts and before we caught on to it. So we just stopped allowing accounts to be created until we can put in a little bit more robust login system.
So your historical volume, you don't think will ever get finished?
Don't know. 15 years, and I've gone from basically the Babylonians to, I think I'm in the 1930s right now.
Well, why don't you do it in volumes so we can see volume 1 through 100 already?
I'm actually, what I'm working on right now is I'm working on Fred Ordway's biography. Fred was a good friend of mine. I'm sure you know who Fred was.
Yeah, he was on the show several times.
Yeah, well, Fred passed away 2 years ago, and one of his final wishes was that his biography be finished, and his family have very kindly trusted me to do that, and so I've been working on that a lot recently. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, I'm actually working on a television series here in Toronto as well, a hard science fiction series called Deep Six, which we have high hopes for is going to sort of do justice to the whole idea of fictional space travel.
What is Deep Six about? Can you give us a hint? Or
basically, it's about a colony around Tau Ceti. You have to sort of get past the whole idea of interstellar travel, which is, you know, one of the big bugaboos in science fiction. A lot of people turn off immediately when you start talking about interstellar travel. So the creators of the show have dug deeply in using the advice of an astrophysicist called Dr. Jamie Matthews, and to try and come up with something that's plausible, but you also have to kind of bite your tongue a little bit and assume that the Alcubierre FTL drive is something that might actually happen one day.
Did you see the movie yet, Passengers?
I have not seen it yet. I have seen Passengers. The Arrival I have not seen. I've seen Passengers, yes.
Yeah, no, they're very different. So they're interstellar there with their 5,000-person sleeper ship and Jennifer Lawrence. So
the old hibernation trick.
Well, I'd wake up with her any day.
You know, the hibernation thing goes back to the 1940s. I mean, the first time anybody, well, I suppose you could say Buck Rogers was in hibernation, but it was not the idea of using hibernation to go deep space travel. It was just to be a wake up in the future. But the first hibernation for deep space travel was in Captain Video in 1949. And the guy who wrote that story for Captain Video is the guy who wrote Space Seed for Star Trek many years later, which, of course, was about Khan being in deep freeze.
What happened in the 1949 Captain Video?
I have to beg that I have not seen it. I've just read the screenplay, and I know the guy who wrote it was the same guy who wrote Space Seed.
So that's where the idea came from.
Yeah, 1949 was the first appearance of it in fiction, anyway, of using hibernation for deep space travel. Of course, Fred Ordway spent an enormous amount of time working on that with the top people in the field at the time in the UK and the USA for Kubrick's movie. And he was told by the top people at the time that they had successfully put various different animals into hibernation that didn't normally hibernate, and then got into the issue of could it be done with humans. And at the time, they said that they thought, given sufficient advances, that it might be possible one day. And, of course, some other people were doing the same thing at the same time with Planet of the Apes. But Kubrick and Clark were filming theirs before Rod Serling and co. were doing Planet of the Apes.
And my show yesterday was about interstellar flight with Rachel Armstrong. Do you know her?
I know the name, yes.
From the UK.
Dr. Rachel Armstrong, right?
Right. And there are some groups that are really pushing forward on interstellar serious culture and development and trying to get people's minds around it, that it might be possible someday. So,
well, it's very tempting now. We see, what is it, over 3,500 exoplanets now?
Uh-huh.
Sort of knowing the cookie jar is just out of reach.
I've got Phil Lubin coming on the show from UC Santa Barbara, who is the physicist involved in the Breakthrough Physics project of sending wafers with laser power at a third the speed of light. And he, at a recent talk at a film festival in L.A., he did not think that the humans would ever be able to go interstellar just because of the mass alone. But artificial intelligence would go.
Which, of course, is also one of the premises that was in 2001, you know, the idea that the Bracewell probe, the monolith, was
right
being sent out as an AI. Another idea, which incidentally Fred Ordway wrote about before he ever met Kubrick, in his 1962 book, I think it was called Intelligence. intelligence in the universe or something like that.
Is AI part of your television series?
It is. It is. And I don't know exactly how it's being used yet, but I'm sure that it's going to be used in a different way to previous things.
Of course,
AI is such a liquid thing right now. It's such a dynamic thing. We're not quite sure what's going to come next.
Are we going to be able to see this series in America, in the States?
I believe so, yes. I couldn't answer that directly. I'd have to get an answer to that from the producers.
Well, I would look forward to that. If you do ever hear about that or get information, make sure you let me know and I'll broadcast
yep.
it. And
it's called Deep Six.
Deep Six.
Yep.
So, you know, when we say somebody Deep Six is something, it's kind of like they throw it away.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this must have a different meaning.
Yeah, there's been some debate about the title, and you know, it's a colloquialism. You know, it's sort of something that's in the vernacular. It's been used for a lot of things over the years.
Now, what is your role in the? Are you the producer of it, or what?
No, I'm a space history consultant.
Space history consultant.
Yep.
Okay, well, they probably have the best. So,
well, thank you.
Is there any? I have a show coming up with. A famous brother from the Vatican on astronomy, Brother Guy, and is what we refer to him as, but I can't think of his full name right now. But aside from the Vatican, are there any modern day William Leaches, ministers, rabbis, whoever, that are also astronomers and doing really innovative scientific and rocketry or space research that you're aware of?
I mean, you already mentioned the obvious one. I mean, there are several of them at the Vatican, and of course
right.
they have that history that goes back a long way. In one of my pocketbooks that I did a number of years ago, I talked about the pocketbook was called Mars, and doing the research, I came across the fact that. Schiaparelli and Lowell were not the first ones to actually use the word canali to describe the lines on Mars that they thought they were seeing. And it was, in fact, the Vatican astronomer Pietro Secchi who first used the term canali when he was observing Mars about 20 years before Schiaparelli. And he actually named one the Blue Canal and one the Atlantic Canal. And so when I stumbled across that one in some very old text, I contacted the Vatican immediately and said, you know, would you happen to have any idea who I'm talking about when I said Father Pietro Secchi? And to their internal credit, the following morning, I had an answer back from them saying, yes, we have his journals here. Would you like pictures of them? And within hours of me saying yes, I had high-resolution color images of Secchi's hand drawings that he'd done in 1858 of Mars. Which I thought was tremendous. You know, they seem to be very open-minded about it.
Amazing. But I don't seem to come across modern people from religion that are guests on the space show, other than the ones I brought in from the Vatican.
Yeah, well, this sort of discussion of science versus religion, obviously I'm in Canada, but we sort of watch a lot of American news here. And U.S. news, I should say. You know, you guys have a very heavy debate going on about this kind of thing all the time because of this evangelical part of the population and versus the secular part. And it doesn't seem to be so pervasive in other countries that I travel to. The people of religious faith in many other countries don't seem to have such a problem with science in general. As they seem to, at least some of them seem to, in the U.S. And I think one of the things about Leach that I just loved about this guy and completely shattered all my illusions of what the world was like 150 years ago was that he was completely open to there being a reconciliation to the point where he even got into things like the anthropic principle of, you know, was the universe really just something that we were imagining? In a highly controversial thing that some people still discuss today, he talked about the creation of matter and was willing to accept that, you know, solar systems may have formed the way that Descartes or Laplace had suggested. But he then postulated the question, well, what about matter itself? Why does it obey these particular laws that created these swirling clouds of gas and dust? And it almost comes across in the way he writes it as a sort of a religious version of the Big Bang Theory. It was incredibly enlightened. And, it seems like we've lost that a little bit today in certain places. People seem to be so polarized in their positions. And I think it's, unfortunately, it's being compounded by a lot of, fake news and that sort of thing.
Helen is in Kansas City, and Helen said in the discussion about life elsewhere in the galaxy or the solar system, did Leach or anybody theorize on meeting extraterrestrial life, and would they be human or something else?
He actually used the words that he didn't necessarily assume that intelligence on another planet would inhabit something that looked like a human. I forget the exact words he used, but he was more or less saying, it doesn't have to look just like us. Whereas Christian Huygens and subsequently de Fontenelle, those guys, had really gone at it head on. And Huygens had said things like, we have this opposable thumb, which allows us to do things with our hands that most other creatures can't. But to suggest that aliens might not have an opposable thumb would be to suggest that monkeys and squirrels are better off than the aliens are. Remarks like that, which, thinking it through and trying to address the fact that it didn't necessarily mean that this was something that only humans would have. He also talked about the idea that having two eyes with stereoscopic vision several feet above the ground had all, an amazing capacity to protect yourself, as did the capacity to hear things. And so Huygens was willing to grant that we had evolved these various different facets of our biology that made so much sense that, it would be ridiculous to assume that something equivalent would not have evolved somewhere else. And he was writing in the 17th century, and his work, as I said earlier, influenced de Fontenelle, and de Fontenelle's work clearly influenced Leach because he had it in his library. We're lucky to be able to say that Leach's library came to Canada, and it still exists. It's in the archives at Queen's University, and it's identified, so we know what books he was reading. And de Fontenelle is in there. So this discussion had been going on for a couple of hundred years about what kind of thing could we expect to see in life on other planets, particularly advanced complex life.
Were you able to access that library at Queen's University?
I actually hope to do that tomorrow. I'm going there tomorrow.
So you haven't been there yet?
No, I've had extraordinarily good assistance by the archivists and librarians there. They've been helping me remotely, and they sent me a handwritten list of everything that Leach had brought with him when he came to Canada in 1860. And, of course, there was Newton in there and Laplace and lots of books on other sciences. Incidentally, one of the other things that Leach had done was when he was at Glasgow University, he had been studying astronomy and became so good at it that when the professor of astronomy and mathematics there was inconvenienced by something that happened, Leach took over as the instructor there for an entire session, which I assume means a semester.
Uh-huh.
And one of the students in the classroom at that time was a young man called William Thomson. And William Thomson became Lord Kelvin, who was the most famous scientist of the 19th century, bar none. And it looks like Leach was his instructor for at least one semester, teaching him astronomy and mathematics. And then later on, when Leach was a minister in Fife, one of the local farmhouses got struck by lightning, and Leach went and studied the effects of this lightning strike to see how things had burned and how the metal had burned, how the plaster had burned, and sent all of his observations back to Glasgow, where Lord Kelvin then used them for his subsequent work on electricity. These guys were thinkers. They were polymaths that were sort of explaining the world to themselves a bit at a time.
Do we have that now, or our thinkers are, I guess it's really different today, isn't it?
Yeah, well, everything's very specialized now today. I mean, to sort of make a name for yourself today, you've got to be focused like a laser on one aspect of your particular field, whereas these guys were really trying to paint the big picture back then.
An amazing story. So how's our timing? I think I can do this one more question. So this is a question from Beth, and Beth is in New Orleans. And Beth says, for people interested in this type of a history, can anyone visit the Leach Archives? What do you have to do to go there and see things and look at the books yourself? I've been to other museums where they have private collections and they open up the galleries from various times. But what happens if you want to go see the collection at the Queen's University?
I'm actually embarrassed to say I don't know the exact answer to that. I will probably have that answer tomorrow. A lot of universities will not allow you into the book stacks. They will allow you to request something and have it brought to you for you to read. I know University of Toronto, where I got some of my research information, some of the original letters that were written to and from Leach are in the library at Toronto University, because he was actually a senator of the University of Toronto as well. And they will bring them to you with a pair of white gloves and a reading table and allow you to look through stuff. But at Queen's, I'm not entirely sure. They have a very large archive there. It's a prestigious university. And my guess would be that if you arranged to go there and contacted the archives and asked them, you know, I would like to look at what's there, they would probably accommodate you with something similar.
I know at some of the political libraries, like the Reagan Library and stuff like that, you access is to bona fide researchers under very tight conditions and control.
Right.
And the Huntington Library, which I've been to, has a lot of things on display that you can see, but you can't really access all of what they have without being an accredited researcher. And there's all sorts of rules and what you have to do and how you can handle items and what you can't handle. And a lot of it's been copied and digitized that you can access, but you can't access the actual, you know, original document and stuff.
So. Yeah, and it varies from institution to institution. I know that in my area here, there are a half a dozen excellent universities, and they all have different rules. Some of them I can walk in off the street, and they'll give me a visitor pass and let me look at stuff. Some of them, you know, you've got to be member of the faculty or a student to be able to do it. So it varies a lot.
What's next for you? Do you have another book in the works?
Well, we're trying to finish Fred Ordway's book right now, and that's quite a task. Fred kept a diary from 1938 to when he passed away in 2014.
Wow.
Every single day. It is a closet full of 4-inch ring binders, which pretty much covers the whole history of the space era. And passing that down into something that's a narrative that's readable is a huge amount of work. So I'm spending a lot of time on that right now. We do have a new book out that just came out, just announced it this week. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. And that's Frank White's new book, The New Camelot, which is following on from his bestseller, The Overview Effect, which is a really interesting read. And
right. Frank is on the show frequently, and I will be sure to ask him and talk to him about that.
Yeah.
When is your Ordway book due out?
Oh, boy. Don't ask me, David.
All right. I'll withdraw the question.
Too much to do still.
Yeah, you have an 11th hour phone call. So,
okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Well, I guess the caller hung up. So, so much for the 11th hour caller. I guess he didn't want to wait, or she didn't want to wait. Rob, this is a great book, and listeners, you can get it off of his website. What is your website address again?
It's apogeebooks.com, A-P-O-G-E-E, books.com, and it's also available on Amazon.
Okay, and I think you'll all really enjoy reading it. It's a great story, and it's part of the history of what we talk about all the time on the space show, so check it out. I'll look forward to hearing from you with more of your publications and staying in touch. And I appreciate your getting back on the show. It's good to hear from you again.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it. And come back tomorrow night, Tuesday. Our schedule is on the website newsletter, the email newsletter, and upcoming shows on the website. So special thanks to Rob for being with us again today. For William Leach for doing his great work a long, long time ago. And for those of you sending in emails, and for the space show. Goodbye, everybody.